Today's show is sponsored by DivvyCloud. DivvyCloud protects cloud and container environments from policy violations, threats, IAM challenges, and misconfigurations. Types of misconfigurations that have cost enterprises a jaw-dropping $5 trillion over the last 2 years. DivvyCloud provides continuous security and compliance across all cloud service providers and containers, including AWS, GCP, Azure, Alibaba, and Kubernetes, providing a comprehensive view of what's in your cloud, along with the tools and automation you need to manage it today. DivvyCloud is proving that security and innovation are not mutually exclusive, one customer at a time. Join innovative enterprises like Spotify, Fannie Mae, and Discovery, who have found the freedom to innovate securely without loss of control. To learn more, visit divvycloud.com/cloudcast. That's divvycloud.com/cloudcast to sign up for a free trial. DivvyCloud. Find your freedom to innovate.
Cloudcast Media presents from the massive studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. This is The Cloudcast with Aaron Delp and Brian Gracely, bringing you the best of cloud computing from around the world.
Good morning, good evening, wherever you are. Welcome back to The Cloudcast. We are coming to you live from the massive Cloudcast studios here in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hope everybody is doing well. We are kind of getting into the second half of August here. For most folks in a lot of different places, the kids are getting back to school. Hopefully they are, you know, in most cases probably doing some distance learning, some virtual learning, which I know not everybody loves, but is probably the most safe record for, you know, most of what's going on. We're seeing a lot of the universities trying to go back and kids getting sick, unfortunately, and maybe having to go home. So hopefully if you have children going to school, they are staying safe. The schools are doing the best they can, and hopefully we can support them as best we can as parents and as technologists and so forth. So with that, let's jump right into Cloud News of the Week. Got a few announcements and a couple of interesting things maybe to take a look at. First off, Datadog, a longtime sponsor, longtime friend of the show, Datadog, acquired Undefined Labs. This allows them to provide visibility into CI and CD environments. They've always provided visibility into, you know, as they like to say on the ads, over 400 integrations, but this gets them more into CI and CD environments. So good to see Datadog continue to grow. Good to see that that group continue to expand out where they can bring value to customers in terms of visibility, observability, and monitoring and so forth. Second was Grafana Labs announced a $50 million round B of funding for observability. So Grafana, a really well-known observability and monitoring and dashboard product in the cloud native space continues to grow. So continue to see, you know, usage of that all over the place. I know we use it as the default in our OpenShift platform in my day job at Red Hat, but see lots and lots of companies doing that. So congratulations to the team at Grafana Labs. Third, this is the KubeCon EU week virtual. So KubeCon, the CNCF is taking KubeCon virtual this week. It was supposed to have been in Amsterdam, got postponed, got moved, got canceled, now becomes virtual. So that's been going on all this week, and they're doing a very good job. Again, you know, always weird to have sort of big industry shows be virtual, but the team is doing a very nice job of, you know, continuing to crank out great learning. And there are a number of announcements. Most of the announcements tend to be either around new companies joining the CNCF, a couple of projects graduating from one stage to another, and then obviously all the vendors are putting out different announcements about you know, new increments they're making to their projects or products and so forth. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And then finally, you know, and I hate to do this, we hate to do this, but boy, oh boy, Google Cloud, you know, a guy named Steve Yeagy, who is very well known in the industry, has been both at Google, at AWS, and kind of a technology, you know, expert, you know, been around for a long time, just wrote a scathing blog this week that a lot of people are talking about, really kind of talking about Google Cloud and their deprecation policy. And, you know, it got a lot of buzz. You know, it's something that, you know, we've talked about a lot on this show. You know, Google's biggest challenge is their brand, the brand of Google as a consumer brand versus the brand of Google as the Google Cloud, an enterprise brand. You know, so it's an interesting article. We don't like to bash on anybody, but, you know, it is one of these things where, you know, Google has, it's something they have to address and something they have to take a look at. So, you know, it's worth a read. He doesn't, you know, the one thing he doesn't tend to do in this article is go into tons and tons of detail. He got burned once or twice. You know, this is one of those recurring things that that Google's just going to have to address, right? It's just kind of part of who they are. It's part of being part of a bigger company, and we won't make any more noise about that. So Anyways, with that, we're going to wrap up Cloud News of the Week. Like always, a couple announcements, a couple of events going on, and some things about what the buzz are. This week, we have a fun show. We like to dig into new topics and things that we've never really dug into before. So this week, we are going to dig into RPA, or Robotic Process Automation, something that we've seen a lot of buzz about, been curious about, and never really dug into it. So we will get to that right after the break. Today's show is sponsored by Datadog, a cloud-scale monitoring platform that unifies metrics, logs, and traces from technologies like Istio, AppMesh, and Envoy. Plus, Datadog's service map automatically plots out the dependencies in your microservices architectures for seamless, context-rich troubleshooting. With rich visualizations, algorithmic alerting, and more than 250 vendor-supported integrations, Datadog allows you to monitor your distributed applications in real time. Start a free 14-day trial today by visiting datadog.com/cloudcast. And Datadog will send you a great free t-shirt. That's datadog.com/cloudcast. And we're back. And folks, you know, there are things that people seem to love about the show. They come back to the show for all the time. And those things are, one, they love that when we introduce them to new startups and kind of new things in that space, there are people that scratches their itch. And then there are, you know, a segment of our audience who loves for us to just talk about things that are kind of brand new to the Cloudcast. They may not necessarily be brand new to the industry, but they're new to the Cloudcast. And one of the things that's been on my radar for a long time now, and I've been seeing it and I've been going, you know, I see it all the time. I keep seeing analysts say, this is a huge thing. It's going to change the industry. And that's this thing called RPA, or Robotic Process Automation. And, you know, it's something that for me, having kind of a business background, but also intersecting with technology, is very interesting, but I've never dug into it. And so we finally got a great chance to dig into it. And so we're going to talk all about RPA today. And so excited to have Mike Kalinowski, who is Senior Manager of Product at Infor. Mike, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me, Brian.
Yeah, great to have you on. Excited to kind of dig into this topic that, like I said, you know, I just keep seeing all these headlines and people talking about kind of this amazing impact it has. But before we dive into that, tell us a little bit about your background. You know, you've been around the industry for a while, but what sort of attracted you to this intersection of business process, saving cost, and the technology that underlies it?
Yeah, so my background, I've been doing this for you know, a little bit more than a decade now, just out of a university and college. And, you know, I got my start actually working at Infor, supporting pre-sales and going out and helping them organize and orchestrate demonstration environments and integration setups, and helping them kind of, you know, bring to light a lot of the capabilities of a given portfolio or vertical that we were pitching to. But it was more behind the scenes. And from there, I actually had an opportunity to grow out of that role and actually go into, you know, the actual implementation side of this. And so I actually joined a customer of Infor at one point and was in charge of executing on their integration strategy and operations. So being able to translate a lot of these business processes in the oil and natural gas industry, a lot of, you know, manual paperwork, fax machine handoffs, and so on, being able to convert that into a lot of, you know, systems automation and systems integration. So from there, you know, I can't say that back then I would have seen what I'm doing today as where I ended up being at. But I think what I found was that for a long time, it's really about trying to solve a lot of these challenges or problems that, you know, I get put in front of. And there's an interest there. And there's definitely an interest in solving these opportunities or these problems in a very clever and elegant way. And so, you know, I had an opportunity to rejoin Infor at a time where they were really making a heavy investment into the technology platform and a really clear unified vision. And very, very exciting because especially with that traversal over to, you know, from on-prem operations to more of a SaaS-based nature, both as a strategy, but also as the, you know, the economy, the customer market was starting to mature and warm up to, you know, the prospect of actually looking at SaaS beyond, you know, Salesforce.com, for example, because everyone's, you know, accustomed to that sort of thing. It was a really, really interesting area to find myself in because I started looking at, you know, how do we solve for SaaS integration strategies with on-prem and legacy systems? How do we actually come up with fairly elegant solutions? So it's really about problem solving for me and then working our way backwards to invent or create or, you know, improve on software that, you know, we have in our portfolio to come up with new ways of doing these things, especially now that we have a lot of the capabilities that we do with, you know, infrastructure as a service with AWS, for example. it lends itself to a lot of creative problem solving, which is really exciting for me, because it's almost like I get to pick the coolest and best technologies and then build and bring to market a product or an idea, especially to the enterprise space, which is, you know, historically not something that you ordinarily saw a lot of innovation in, a lot of creativity, a lot of usability and promotion of, you know, new ways of operating the same kinds of work that we've been doing for the last, you know, century.
Right. Right. Yeah, I know. I mean, the first time I think I maybe had heard of Infor, I remember this was maybe 4 or 5 years ago. Maybe it was actually a little longer than that. Your CEO was on stage with Andy Jassy at reInvent. He was talking about, you know, moving the entire company, all of the, you know, the ways that you delivered technology into the public cloud. You know, it's kind of making this very big, bold statement. And I remember, you know, it was on my radar at that point. And it's very cool that you've gone from, you know, you were helping some companies with it at one point in sort of an early iteration of it. You went and lived with those types of problems. You went and lived with, you know, the way that you have to be creative as a business. And now you're back on the other side of things going, okay, let me take both those sets of knowledges and this new delivery paradigm and, you know, and trying to put it into reality. So very, very cool to kind of blend this change in how things are delivered, change in the technology with, you know, you having, you know, lived on both sides of the fence. You kind of really understand the customer's pain points, but you also understand where, when you can be creative, you know, that offers, you know, tremendous, you know, kind of business value and opportunity to change how things happen within companies. That's very, very cool. For anybody who's not familiar with this concept, if they've never heard of RPA or, you know, robotic process automation, give us the basics. Walk us through, you know, what it is and kind of where it applies to, you know, literally everybody's business.
Yeah, so good key question to launch into, because I think the terminology has kind of been floating around the industry and the analyst space for a few years now. Hasn't really latched or gotten as strong of a hold. We've seen a lot of things like data lakes, pipelining, IoT, blockchain. Sorry to bring that one up.
Sure.
But a lot of these buzzword topics, you know, kind of emerge, evolve, and I don't want to say fizzle, but, you know, it matures, it becomes a little bit more shop-worn or a little bit more familiar. RPA is really starting to come into its own, and we're starting to see greater interest from especially the analyst community, but I think also, you know, this convergence with some of the technologies and capabilities that you can do in the cloud. But, you know, RPA at its core is really about being able to put repetitive processes in motion that your business users are running on a day-to-day basis. So the monotony of, you know, order entry or inventory replenishment tasks, being able to take, you know, these button clicks and keyboard strokes and being able to translate that into software that actually does this for themselves. And I think, you know, if you put a box around the typical tasks that an integration analyst or an administrator might be responsible for, they're really working with functional users, ERP manuals, documents, and so on to translate overall business flow and then introduce workflow automation into their enterprise. And what that results in is you've got, especially when your organization starts to grow, you know, anytime you add in more than one system on top of your ERP, now you're having to solve for integration. So how do I get these two systems to talk? Yeah. And so that's typically what an integration hat is really looking to address. But that's really about integrating these systems to be in sync with one another about what's happening on one side of the business so that the other part is aware of how to execute certain business transactions. But a lot of the work that goes into, you know, what the user is actually running on a day-to-day basis behind their keyboard, their console, their mouse, a lot of that is not translated into automated work. That might be UI, that might be fields and workflow and patterns on how to process a particular workflow, but they're still stuck there behind the computer spending, you know, a percentage of their day, you know, clearing out the backlog and workflow for order processing, you know, inventory management, AR, AP type transactions that, you know, after a period of time, it becomes very, very tedious. And so while integration's a bread and butter for any significantly, you know, or sufficiently complex company that starts juggling multiple systems, RPA is really about taking what is my user actually running in terms of their personal workflow and then translating that into software that can help ease a lot of the tedium of actually running their day-to-day, you know, operational processes from a very hyper-localized perspective. You know, I don't want to be sitting behind my computer for an hour or two a day. doing data entry tasks that could be better served by, you know, software that's going to do the same exact thing for me, right? Yeah. So it's being able to record a lot of these tasks that really, you know, it's great that we have a workforce to do this, but we have to have a workforce in order to close out these transactions and to automate a lot of these processes. But if we're able to shift what they're focused on and, you know, automate some of that that value, then they're free to also spend their time looking at other ways to improve the business, shift some of their time and their focus on learning new capabilities, scaling up elsewhere in the company, and then being able to add value in other parts of the business. And so that's a lot of the value add that RPA brings to the table here.
Yeah. Okay. So, and that's really helpful. I think, you know, sometimes we think about, we're going to integrate this system with that system. We get into a lot of, you know, it used to be, you know, middleware and SOA and these things that were kind of API driven or interface driven. This is, you know, there's a whole nother space in there that is, like you said, everything from, you know, people, you know, managing stuff that may have originated as paper and that becomes digitized. You've got processes around, you know, claims, like you said, accounts payable. It could be a claim at a doctor's office. It could be, you know, getting reports from places and being able to scan through them. Like, give us a sense of, you know, what are some of the kind of the basic technologies then that you're having to think about in order to start putting all these things together? Because a lot of this stuff, you know, doesn't have an API, or it wasn't designed to be, you know, easily integrated with lots of stuff. Like, what are some of those core technologies that are the foundation of this? And then you're beginning to do more interesting things on top of.
Yeah. So it's actually a particularly strong suit of RPA to address those types of use cases, because, you know, it wasn't until Bezos and Amazon released the API manifesto, more than 10 years ago at this point. Right.
Right.
And even then, it took a while before really everything was programmatically enabled within Amazon. And then that started taking a foothold within other organizations and enterprises. Now that we're seeing this in the enterprise space, I think we can, you know, safely assume that everything is API first and enabled. But, you know, making a decision around an ERP implementation oftentimes is a once in a career decision.
Right.
And so you still tend to see a lot of organizations that are running AS/400 mainframe machines, and for good reason, by the way.
Right.
But at the same time, they are not necessarily API enabled, or they don't necessarily make a lot of their interfaces easily accessible, or there's a lot of capital cost, both in, you know, time, labor, investment, knowledge, scaling up to actually get into really integrating these processes between some of these older systems out there. And so, you know, even today, you still see some modern applications that don't necessarily have, you know, RESTful approaches towards exposing, you know, discrete functionality within their application. So, you know, when you're thinking about RPA, it actually becomes a very, very appealing low-cost approach, because you already have users that are interacting with an application. Oftentimes, menus, buttons, fields, you know, keys on their keyboard for tabbing through different parts of the form of an application. You already have an interface that's exposed to your functional users. So you might not have that programmatic approach to call an API or call a, you know, a system report or a process or something of the sort, but you do have an interface available to you. So using that knowledge, being able to now actually start screen recording the performance of user activities, what they're actually doing on a day-to-day basis to close out, you know, an order invoice or something of that sort, or, you know, OCR or transcribe, you know, form elements from a PDF or even, you know, fax documentation that's coming from the field or something like that. It becomes very, very powerful, because you're not having to spin your cycles on figuring out how do I integrate these applications, but you're actually looking at the surface, truly the surface level value of, you know, how can I take what I have available to my users and actually still drive, you know, automation and value on top of that.
Yep.
So in the same way that you can fire up Camtasia screen recording software as well to capture, you know, your body or tribal knowledge, so that you can share that within the you know, your particular domain or space, you know, with RPA software, yeah, you don't necessarily need to have API access or even data or relational system access. You just need access to the knowledge that's captured within your functional users, and then you can translate that into automation itself. And so despite not actually having these APIs, there's a tremendous amount of value in being able to create new types of value, basically, on top of, you know, what your users are doing on a day-to-day basis. And so it doesn't preclude you from being able to invest in RPA. And in fact, I would actually say it's one of the stronger suits of what makes RPA so appealing, especially right. when you're starting to look at some of the new technologies that are coming out and around the space to start doing this type of key and screen capture and so on.
Yeah, I'm sort of getting this visual in my head as you're explaining this to me. I you know, if I'm drawing concentric circles or overlapping circles, like there's one circle that says, you know, save cost, and that could either be like, I just want to drive profitability for the business, or I don't want to invest in a brand new system, right? So work with what I have. I've got another circle that overlaps that says, you know, there is domain expertise that's still, you know, valuable from the people that are doing this day to day. They understand why the processes were built. They understand that. So they're a valuable piece of this. And then, you know, the third circle is, you know, your users, you know, the end receivers of whatever this thing is. It could be, you know, a process, it could be whatever. They're not getting any more patient, right? They want things faster and faster. And sort of in between those three things is, you know, of those concentric circles would be RPA. It goes, that's the thing that solves this problem between, you know, I want to be more profitable, I want to save cost, I want to maintain some amount of domain expertise with the people that are there, and my users want this faster and faster. And that's kind of the sweet spot of where this fits. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, 110%. Okay. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of mutual benefit, both mm-hmm. to functional users that are actually, you know, running the business from a back office perspective, to, you know, the IT administrators and that, you know, knowledge segment within IT and systems management to create a lot of value over here, because integration is not necessarily a cheap endeavor. You know, right. You might sink some capital costs into an integration platform, but the work ain't going to do itself. And so you do need to dig into what are my opportunities to integrate these applications. And, you know, you certainly can integrate applications awfully quickly, especially, you know, when you have a canonical body of integration capabilities and languages available to you. But, you know, when you're stuck with older applications or you're having to invest a lot of time, and time is money, then IT is having to dedicate a lot of its resource and spend into integrating applications. And maybe that's just not available this budget year. And right. So RPA is a very appealing low-hanging fruit to provide that value without necessarily commandeering a lot of the budget and expenditures from IT to do something at the integration level or the SOA level.
Yep.
And then on the flip side too, you know, there's been a lot of talk in general about, you know, automation and replacement of, you know, employment opportunities or labor. But what we're also finding, and I think there's been a lot of, you know, academic research into this, is that especially in that knowledge worker space, these aren't tasks that people enjoy doing on a day-to-day basis. This is what they're getting paid to do, absolutely. But this is not where they're creating really good competent values to the organization. They're just simply doing a job to be done and then moving on with their day to the next task and the next task or the next business decision and so on. And so being able to free up a lot of that capacity spent on, you know, very, very low IQ type of remedial tasks is obviously to their benefit as well. And we often see that RPA doesn't replace workers or doesn't replace labor, doesn't replace, you know, a person's job. It actually helps them become a little bit more happy with what they're actually doing because they're not stuck doing the same thing, right. You know, hour in and hour out, right? So it's mutually beneficial to all parts of the organization. And certainly when you look at top line growth and productivity, I mean, it's a tremendous boon to, you know, how productive, you know, the people actually running the business become within the organization.
Yeah, and I do want to dive into some of the numbers that I see ROI wise. Before I get to that though, I have to imagine, you know, Infor's been doing this for a while. You're going to have a bunch of native capabilities to help, like you said, those legacy systems kind of get modernized, more automated. But I have to imagine that you're also seeing the challenge that somewhere in some of these processes, you are going to have a SaaS application, you are going to have an API, you are going to have, you know, some other things that are coming into that process flow. Is that a reality in what you're seeing? Is this sort of hybrid between, you know, an existing ERP system, some manual tasks, some things that are now becoming, you know, SaaSified with an API? Like, are all these things part of the challenge today?
I think it's part of the evolution, right? So I think RPA at its core is really about that screen capture and reproducing these types of tasks. But when you look at the opportunity in terms of how I can start blending in, you know, the fact that I do have connected systems that do have APIs, that I do have AI and machine learning capabilities within a portfolio, how can we start weaving this together? And so, you know, Infor, just as a little bit of background, we grew out of acquisitions. And so our portfolio is very rich in a very, very wide range of technologies and capabilities. But oftentimes that becomes very challenging to integrate with. And so, you know, our first step more than a decade ago was to introduce, you know, a competent integration platform that really solves for, you know, canonical language. How do my applications speak together? Doesn't matter if they're .NET, Java, or what have you, but how can we agree that these same business concepts mean the same thing across all systems? And so that was a really effective way to get started. And what we ended up introducing over time was layering in new types of capabilities from document management to API gateways to, you know, even data lakes. And you had a really interesting Cloud Mesh interview several podcasts ago. And I thought it was really, really insightful and thoughtful because, you know, a lot of issues were raised in terms of how companies approach, you know, their investments in terms of technologies. I have a problem. I'm going to go out to the market and buy best of breed. Yeah. But they don't really look at contextually how is this going to fit into the rest of my system. And so it becomes very, very interesting to approach this not from the technology side and then looking at how do we address this in the ERP space, but actually coming at this from inside, you know, the ERP area and actually innovating technologies to address on what our enterprise customers need. So it's very interesting because we started addressing these, you know, domain-specific requirements. Well, we got on board with developing APIs for all of our enterprise applications from CRM to ERP and so on. So we need a gateway to address that. We have an integration platform, as I mentioned, to address, you know, this acquisition portfolio that we've been developing from, you know, the good old days with Bond to, you know, more recent acquisitions like Nexus and Burst. And so we developed these technologies to address very specific needs at a time and a place. But over time, what we see is that there's a lot of layered value in having all these different technologies under the single technology platform that we call Infor OS, and actually being able to weave capabilities and functionality from one area. So for example, like our AI platform, and actually being able to now call APIs just in time, or being able to weave AI into RPA systems and processes. We have these APIs already available to us. We have this RPA process available to start recording, you know, screen capture and what the users are actually performing. Why not actually start to think about how can we blend and blur the lines between these previously domain-specific products so that we can start evolving what RPA is? And you'll start to hear more, I'm sure, you know, around the analyst community. This is known as hyperautomation, but you might hear this as intelligent process automation. But it really is, Brian, it's evolving beyond just simply, you know, capturing what you see is what you get on the screen, and actually taking different parts of, you know, the systems that you have available to you, the information, the data, and actually starting to blend a lot of these different APIs and services into that RPA flow as well. And yeah. So over time, you know, those pillars, those walls kind of get knocked down and it gets blurrier and blurrier because you're able to create a lot more value when you start synergizing between, you know, APIs and machine learning platforms and data lakes and big data and being able to weave that back into, you know, the decisions that are actually happening in the RPA space.
Right, right. No, and you know, so many of these things are you know, so pattern driven, right? I mean, they're somewhat repetitive, but they're pattern driven. I can imagine, you know, you start applying some better intelligence to it, whether it's AI or ML, you're going to see, you know, not only the process itself could become automated, but some optimizations around that as well. And that's, you know, it's exciting to see those things start to be blended together and blurred together. And obviously, you know, at the bottom line is it becomes really helpful for businesses to be, you know, more profitable, more efficient in what they deliver to the market. So that's all very, very cool. Who, you know, a lot of times we'll spend time on the show talking about different topics, and at some point you go, okay, that's all cool, you know, in theory, but like, who owns that? Like, is there an owner to it? So is there an organization? Is there a title that you would look for that's sort of driving RPA, intelligent RPA within an organization? Because this feels like it crosses multiple silos of different teams and different organizations. Like, is there becoming, you know, a way that these groups are organized, or a title that's kind of bubbling to the surface?
Oh, goodness. You know what? I don't know if there's necessarily a title. I'm going to guess business analyst, because okay. That's what everyone has been for 4 or 5 decades, when no one knows what to define what it is that they do.
Okay.
So I'm a business analyst. But it's interesting. I don't think that you can just go to Lone Solo as a functional user and just go and, you know, pick up a piece of software off the shelf. I think, you know, you've heard stories on, you know, Slashdot and Hacker News and Reddit of people, you know, writing Python code to automate a lot of their job, or they're even outsourcing it. Makes news because it's, you know, so provocative sometimes, but, you know, that doesn't really scale within an organization, and that might reduce some of the tedium of that person's tasks, but that's not really solving at an organizational level. And so it's not just one person that I see as really addressing that RPA flow. It's not just a functional user saying, all right, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to record what I do on a day-to-day basis, I'm going to set it, and I'm going to forget it.
Gotcha.
I really think that you need to have someone with that expertise, and oftentimes that tends to be someone within that information services and information technology space that's helping complement and coach this process. Because, you know, RPA is especially great when everything's going to plan and going well. You know, I recorded what I do on a day-to-day basis, but I forgot what happens if I didn't account for this one error or edge case scenario, right? So being able to get coached by someone within that information technology space, especially, you know, the ones that are responsible for putting these systems in front of you, really sets you up and tees you up for a level of success that you might not necessarily, you know, be able to create if you just simply go this alone as, you know, a finance user, or, you know, back office, or an inventory manager, or demand planner, or something of that sort. So
gotcha. It really makes sense.
Yeah.
Makes sense. So, you know, I was looking a little bit, we haven't dug in a lot into Infor specific or Infor OS. I was kind of digging around the web pages and all. It feels like some of the graphical ways that the technology builds out processes, represents them, kind of overlaps with some of these things we're hearing with low code and no code. Is that, you know, like, is this, are these buzzwords sort of overlapping? Are we seeing a certain amount of that in which, like you said, business analysts now just have more powerful tools to, you know, kind of surface that underlying technology? Or is that, you know, kind of the low code, no code space kind of a much different area than what you typically see?
Yeah, I think there's a bridge between the two, you know, and I just saw actually BBC had an article on low code just on the front page. So, you know, I think that's definitely, you know, that ship has arrived in mm-hmm. terms of worker productivity and the capabilities of no code. And to the point that now this is actually making, you know, international news and you know, being distributed amongst, you know, daily readers of the Sunday paper. So it's a really, really interesting to see how low code, no code is actually evolving, because there are implications in people's day-to-day lives and productivity and workforce habits. But yeah, a lot of the software that we end up building, we do try and create those types of abstractions, because at the end of the day, there's a lot of complexity to running a business, to running, you know, business process workflows, to making decisions. And being able to abstract that a couple of levels or an order of magnitude higher to actually provide graphical interfaces to manage this helps you focus on how am I connecting my systems? How am I informing my users? How am I, you know, actually also from an information technologist point of view, more importantly, how am I actually tracking what's actually happening within my organization or my company, right? So I'm now able to, as an administrator, be able to better manage, well, actually, how is data moving between systems? How is data being surfaced to people, and focus on being able to create value in terms of the experiences that you can drive, right? Yeah. So it's about being able to surface exceptions that happen within a perfectly ordinary process, but be able to notify them on a mobile application or really any sort of, you know, device that they might be logged into, whether that's, you know, email, mobile, desktop computing, and so on. So to some degree, yeah, there's this tremendous influence of no code, low code that we try to employ when it comes to delivering on, especially, out of the box services and functionality. And that's something that, we package together as cloud suites, which is, ERPs and CRM products and PLM and so on. At the end of the day, there's a connective tissue with InfoOS at the center of it that knows all the information that's being exchanged, that provides you with that tracking and traceability. And really, you're just modeling the movement of information and synchronicity between systems. But there's always going to be that need also for, more advanced capabilities or interfaces. So I think, low code is really taking off and has been. It's been a big influence, I think, across the industry over the last, good 5 years is what we're seeing. Makes it certainly a lot easier, especially now that so many things are API enabled, to create new types of interfaces, whether that's slimming down the amount of noise pollution on the screen to make a decision or to complete a data entry task, to, designing new types of experiences that blend data across, three different vendors and two different, ERP products and, pulling in some data from a legacy product. That's really, really tremendous in terms of value add and productivity recovered, because now you're not having to traverse so many different systems. And so there's so many avenues on the low code, no code perspective that that adds so much value in different areas and depending on, sort of where you sit and what kind of hat you're wearing. But ultimately, I think that's also one of the main ways that we try and also drive success and adoption of these technologies. So AI and machine learning, data lakes, that tends to be, historically, these are very buzzwordy. They're exciting. We see them in consumer technologies. And yep. So, I want some of that, but I want it in my company.
Yep.
And then you start getting into it. All right. So I'm setting up, our studio and Julia and Python and MATLAB and so on and so forth. And when you look at what this entails, we don't have that consumer experience. So if we want to see adoption and we want customers and the market and people to recognize this value and what can actually add to their day-to-day, you can't have all this complexity at your fingertips. It's very powerful on one hand, but there's certainly a lot more business analysts out there that are able to understand the business process than there are data scientists that can do the same.
Gotcha.
And so, it's something that we try and promote and prioritize. Because otherwise, it's very, very challenging to create ROI opportunities or value when you're spending most of the time reading the manual and watching tutorial videos.
Right.
So being able to deliver that no-code, low-code experience that really gets your foot in the door to start experimenting and embedding machine learning predictions into functional user interfaces in the ERP, that's easy to grasp. That's easy to jumpstart and, get the rocket ship going compared to, what it was a few years ago.
Yep. Very, very cool. Listen, this has been great. I feel like, at least for myself, I know a whole lot more about this. It puts it into a much better context for me. For anybody listening, if you want to kind of maybe get started about this, learn a little bit more, like what are good entry points for people that are, curious about the space, maybe a quick way for them to start learning some of this stuff?
Oh, yeah. Goodness. The internet is no shortage of this. But I think, looking at RPA software, checking out vendor websites, but I think really looking at video tutorials on YouTube, looking at things like InfoOS helps you kind of visualize a lot of that experience to better start implementing and wrapping your mind about what's the value proposition here rather than just simply hearing about it. So I think, starting to look at analyst studies and especially what's making it to the top of, the analyst leaderboards in terms of, market trends, I think that's a great foot in the door to figure out where should I be investing my reading time in terms of how do I actually do this, but then taking it a step further, taking a look at, vendor websites, Infor.com and so on, to actually start exploring what actually, what is the usability? What is the potential ROI use cases? How are actually other people solving this too? I think looking for case studies helps to map as an analog, what can we take away from other people that have already done this? And how can we benefit from a lot of their knowledge that they've already started publishing, in terms of videos, case studies, content, and actually start thinking about how do we promote this for a discussion within our own, information services organization?
Yep. Very cool. Very cool. We'll get some stuff in the show notes for folks that that want to dig into this some more. We'll give you some simple links. Mike, thank you so much for the time today. It's been very interesting. It's been very, very useful. Folks, as always, we love to get feedback from you. You know how to reach us at show@thecloudcast.net. But as always, you know, you can always, you know, give us feedback. You can rate us on iTunes. We appreciate you coming back to us every single week. And with that, we will talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to The Cloudcast. Please visit thecloudcast.net to find more shows, show notes, videos, and everything social media.